Welcome to a Juno Afternoon on Monday, April 24th, 2017. I'm your host, Scott Burton. Glad to have you with us. On today's show, Dr. Kim Hort will give us an update on the new dental clinic at Search. We'll learn about this year's Juno Fine Arts Camp. We'll get the details about Aware's Girls on the Run and Boys 5K. And Jim Powell will be here to highlight food security in Juno. Those interviews, National Native News, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note Music, and more right here, live and local on a Juno afternoon. Currently 54 degrees in Juno and Huna, 55 in Gustavus.
This is National Native News. I'm Art Hughes, in for Antonia Gonzalez. Blackfeet Nation voters overwhelmingly approved a compact worth more than $471 million, and that settles usage rights for water resources flowing through the Flathead Indian Reservation in Montana. The agreement with federal and state officials culminates some four decades of disputes and negotiations. Tribal leaders call it one of the most important developments of the last 100 years. The tribal vote solidifies the agreement that was previously ratified by federal and state governments. The federal government provides $422 million for water-related projects. The state chips in an additional $49 million. A Navajo Nation citizen is awaiting for a federal judge to set his trial date related to the shooting death of police officer Houston Largo. Kirby Cleveland entered a not guilty plea to eight counts stemming from the shooting. Four of those counts are punishable by the death penalty. Police arrested Cleveland the day after Largo was shot to death as he responded to a domestic abuse call March 11th near Grants, New Mexico. Pueblo communities in New Mexico are remembering a leader who raised Pueblo history into the national spotlight. Herman Aguayo of Okeowingue died this month. As Hannah Colton reports, the cultural activist and author is known for, among other things, putting a statue of the Pueblo revolt leader Pope into the National Statuary Hall in Washington, D.C.
Pope was the architect of the 1680 revolution that drove Spanish conquistadors away for 12 years and helped Pueblo communities be able to hold on to their cultural identities. But Pope got scant mention in New Mexico history books before Herman Aguayo took on his cause. Benny Shendo Jr. of Jemez Pueblo is a state senator and former cabinet secretary for the New Mexico Department of Indian Affairs. He says there was no Native representation in National Statuary Hall in D.C. before Aguayo achieved his goal in 2005.
It was almost, 30-plus years of work that finally culminated into Pope taking his place in Washington. And I think Herman, over those years, really educated a lot of people of the significance of that first revolution.
Born in 1934, Aguayo attended the Santa Fe Indian School before going off to college in Manhattan, New York. He returned to his home village, earned a master's degree, and later held leadership positions in tribal and intertribal government. Okeowingue tribal member Elena Ortiz remembers Aguayo as a gentle, soft-spoken man who was a constant supportive presence in the Pueblo.
To me, a warrior is someone who defends their people, who stands up for their people, who serves, and that was Herman. So we've lost a statesman, we've lost a warrior.
Aguayo's health was deteriorating for several years before he died at the age of 82. For National Native News, I'm Hannah Colton.
Students in Montana cannot be prohibited from wearing traditional regalia to graduation ceremonies. Governor Steve Bullock signed a bill that allows Native American students to wear feathers, beads, and other items of cultural significance. The bill, signed Friday, applies to public schools statewide. Previously, the decision was left to individual school districts. The bill, sponsored by Billings Senator Jen Gross, comes after several students protested resistance from school administrators to allow beaded mortarboards and other displays of cultural heritage. A new report counters the longstanding belief that more Native Americans and Alaska Natives live in urban rather than rural areas. The study, released Thursday by the First Nations Development Institute, recalculates what they say is an outdated definition of urban. Researchers use the definition of rural developed by the Housing Assistance Council. Using the new calculations, they say 54% of those who identify themselves as Native Americans or Alaska Natives on the U.S. Census live in places that are considered rural. The study's authors say foundations and other organizations operated with the assumption from a previous study that almost three-quarters live in urban areas. Earlier assessments used a definition of urban as towns having as little as 4,000 residents. With National Native News, I'm Art Hughes.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
Support by BNSF Railway Company, supporting STEM careers since 1990 as a corporate partner of the American Indian Science and Engineering Society. BNSF STEM scholarships available at aises.org/scholarships.
And by the law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller & Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States, with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
You're listening to a Juno afternoon here on Monday, April 24th, 2017. Scott Burton, your host, and it's about 6 minutes after the hour. In the studio now is Dr. Kim Hort. She's a pediatric dentist over at Search. Welcome to the show, Kim.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, nice to have you here. So a lot of stuff going on at Search these days with the dental practice. Tell us about what's going on.
There sure is. So a couple of years ago, we identified that our pediatric population was growing kind of exponentially. And so we started making some plans to expand our program. And so over the past couple of years, we've not only hired on 2 more full-time pediatric dentists, which brings us to 3 full-time, but we've also are pretty close to finishing a new remodel of the lower floor of our building to be just strictly a kids clinic.
Okay, and when you say kids, what's the age range for that?
Yeah, so we like to see patients anywhere between the age of 0 and up to about 17. It's a little bit of a loose upper age limit because we will see we'll see patients up until their teenage years or whenever they're ready to graduate on to adult dentistry.
Okay, and you do have a grand opening coming up on June 22nd, right?
We do.
All right, what can people expect on that day?
So on that day, between 1 and 3 o'clock, we plan to give some tours, so our staff will be available to tour the clinic. I'm really excited about how the clinic looks. It's really beautiful with some custom artwork, so I'm excited to show that off. And we'll also have a ribbon-cutting ceremony and an opportunity for some thank yous for some of our key funders that have helped to make the project possible.
Okay. What do pediatric dentists focus on as opposed to, say, general dentists?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's a question I get a lot is why would you bring your child to a pediatric dentist versus a general dentist? And it's not always a clear distinction. Pediatric dentists have additional 2 to 3 years of training beyond dental school where they focus just on growth and development and the psychology of kids, because we know kids just aren't little adults. They kind of come with their own unique physiology, and baby teeth are a little bit different than adult teeth. And so pediatric dentists are trained to kind of be a little bit more receptive to the needs of kids and focus on baby teeth, but also really to be aware of growth and development issues as kids are growing. And then we also have some additional training on treating children that may have some special health care needs as well. So just to be a little bit more aware of some of those factors and how they impact their oral health.
And when a kid has their baby teeth, can their care affect their teeth later in life?
Absolutely. So not only just from a general perception of healthcare, so just kind of how comfortable kids are coming to the dentist and having a good relationship with their oral healthcare provider, but also infections on baby teeth can be really devastating to kids and can definitely affect how their adult teeth form and develop. So yeah, I think it's a whole package for sure.
And you were talking earlier about sort of a new trend, which is individualized dental care. Can you speak on that?
Yeah, so I think for a really long time, we kind of had the approach that every patient should come for a checkup and a cleaning every 6 months. And there's been a bit of a shift in thinking over the past, 10 years or so, where we're kind of looking at individual risk factors. I think there are some people that do a really great job taking care of their teeth, and they brush and they floss, and they tend to get a new cavity every time they go to the dentist. There are other people who maybe don't take as good care of their teeth, have a diet that's a little bit more rich in sugars, and they tend to not grow cavities. And the reason is because we're not all the same. We all have different factors. And so in dentistry, we've been starting to look a little bit more at what those risk factors are for cavities as well as for periodontal health, and then try to customize treatment plans where some people are coming to the clinic every 3 months for checks, where other people might come every 18 months, depending on what their risk factors and their history has been.
Okay. I will let you pick the age, but what would like sort of outline for us perfect dental care and diet?
Yeah,
for,
that's really tricky.
I don't know what, 10-year-old, 15-year-old,
right.
What, you choose.
Right. So let's see. So for, say, a 5-year-old, so a kiddo who's just starting kindergarten, we really encourage those kids to have some parental help with brushing their teeth. Studies show that kids don't have the manual dexterity they need to brush their own teeth until they can write their name in cursive or tie their own shoes. So that's a little bit later on. So even through the age of 5 or 6, we expect that parents are helping with tooth brushing morning and nighttime for sure. Flossing any teeth that touch. So if the teeth have spaces between them, tooth brushing is fine. But as soon as teeth are touching, we encourage some flossing once a day as well.
Okay. Again, there is a grand opening where you can learn more, and you serve the whole community, is that right?
We do, yeah. Search is known primarily for native healthcare, but within the pediatric dental population here in Juneau and in most of our outlying communities, Search has really opened its doors to all family members. So that includes both native and non-native participants or members of our community. And we also do some outreach trips to some of our smaller communities, and Search is here in Juneau is a referral center for those communities. So we have lots of kids that are flying in for specialty care if they need it as well.
And there are 3 of you pediatric dentists.
There
right?
are, yep.
And a lot more going on, an internship program.
Yeah,
did you say?
So in our adult dentistry, we have a residency program. So there are some dentists that will choose to do a year or two of additional training after dental school, just in general dentistry. And so here in Juneau and in Sitka as well, we have 2 to 3 residents a year that spend an additional year or two sometimes with us learning about general dentistry. And they spend a little bit of time in the pedo clinic, and they learn a little bit about braces and root canals and all kinds of things, and leave here being richer for it.
And you were also saying that you serve adults with special needs?
That's right. So one of the things that's not commonly known is that pediatric dentists, a part of our 2-year training, is adult special needs patients as well. And so often it's hard for adult special needs patients to find dental care. Not all dentists are comfortable with that population. But if that is a need, then a pediatric dentist is a good place to look for getting some of that care.
Okay, a lot going on at the Search Dental Clinic. Grand opening June 22nd. What are the hours for that?
I think it's 1 to 3 in the afternoon, and we'll have some announcements coming out with more information, too.
And remind us where it is. I think a lot of us know. But
yeah, so it's right by Twin Lakes. The address is 3245 Hospital Drive. It's just down the hill from the hospital and from the Search Medical Clinic.
Okay, and you can also call 789-KIDS, right?
Absolutely. That's our number if you want to make an appointment or get more information about our program.
Kim, thanks for coming on the show. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
No, that was great, Scott. Thank you.
Thank you.
Couldn't be seen dead here in the day. I guess you're lucky that it's dark now. And if I like it, then we'll stay. Impress the Empress, take a shot now. We got the glow in the mouth. White teeth, jeans are out. White teeth, jeans are out. If you want, we'll help tonight to split it seams. Give the bruises out like gifts. You'll get the picture of your dream. I won't be smiling, but the notes from my admirers fill the dashboard just the same.
We got the glow in the mouth.
White teeth, jeans are out.
Oh,
you in on something big. I am not a white-teeth teen. I tried to join, but never did. The way they are, the way they see, is something else. It's in the blood. Their molars blinking like the lights in the underpass where we all sit and do nothing and love it.
The Alaska State Improv Festival returns to McPheeters Hall in the Hangar Ballroom, April 27 to May 1, with groups from across the continent featuring Listen Sams from San Francisco. Shows begin at 6:30 each night. The Alaska State Improv Festival, April 27 to May 1, McPheeters Hall and the Hangar Ballroom. Visit asifest.com for more details. Alaska State Improv Festival, April 27 to May 1, asifest.com.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Monday, April 24th. It's about 17 minutes after the top of the hour. And in the studio now is Julie Diana. She's the ED of Juno Dance Theater, which is the grand organizer of the Juno Fine Arts Camp. Welcome to the show, Julie. Nice to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, so 40 years.
Yes.
The Juno Fine Arts Camp.
Yes, yes.
That's a long time.
It is a long time. It's one of those staple enrichment art camps that have been so popular with families all these years. So we're really proud that it's under our umbrella.
Yeah, I don't think a lot of people know that, right?
They don't. A lot of people don't know it. We receive great support from the City and Borough of Juno Youth Activities Grant. And, we're the producing organization of this camp.
And you were telling me that when it first started 40 years ago that maybe it did really have a focus on dance, mm-hmm. but of course now it's really expanded, right?
It has. I think in the early 90s it really expanded to encompass all different kinds of fine arts. So I'm looking at some of our classes. We have some great new classes that we're offering this year. We have Beasts of the Southeastern Wild, which is really fun. Students use stories, folklore to create their own mythical creatures and monsters out of recycled and collected materials. We have some of those really popular staple classes, cooking, a lot of bucket drumming, ukulele, beginner and intermediate. This year we're also having an inventor's lab. So there's a lot of invention, a lot of science. We're offering French, introduction to French, so language arts. And, of course, we do have our dance components. So there's creative movement, art of movement. There's some contemporary in there as well. So a lot of really diverse raven's tail weaving. I think I can go on and on. We have about 32 different class offerings for grades, children entering grades K through 6.
Okay. And who teaches these classes? You said 32?
32 classes, right. And we have professional artist teachers. So local artists in the community, teachers who are bringing their expertise to this camp. Perhaps they work in the school district during the year, or they're individual artists in the community who are offering their time and services and working for our camp over the summer.
Okay, and so this is through the month of June, right?
Correct.
4 weeks of
Correct.
Classes.
Mm-hmm.
And a child can take one or all 4 weeks?
Yes, one or all 4 weeks. And we also have morning only, afternoon only, or full day options available. So a lot of different ways families can take advantage of this experience. We also offer pre-camp care, and then we coordinate with Rally for after camp hours as well. So there are a lot of different opportunities. What's really fun is that It empowers, I think, well, at least my children feel this way as well. They get to choose their own classes. So they get to go and look at the descriptions, look at the schedules, and piecemeal together what interests them most. So I feel like it's a really empowering experience for students.
Paint a picture for us, like a day in the life of one of the students. You mentioned pre-camp care, then the camp itself, and possibly rally afterwards. When does it start? When does it end? And where might they go all day?
Right. So the classes happen at JDHS. So we have a variety of classrooms that we have reserved. We have the kitchen space. Pre-camp care happens on site. And then that's, you know, from 8 to 9 potentially. And then students can go to 50-minute classes. So each class is in 50-minute increments. They have 10 minutes to switch classes. There's a lunch break. Some of the classes are happening outside. There's Nature Sketchbook. There's a great new one this year called I Spy. So they're going to take students on excursions to very specific landmarks in the community and make their own I Spy books. So a lot of really interesting ways to incorporate outside play as well with arts, both in and out of JDHS.
Excellent. And then lunch, right? And do they bring their own or is it provided?
Bring your own bag lunch, yes.
And what time does the day end?
The day ends at 2:30. And then afterwards, they'd coordinate with rally. So a full day experience for the classes could potentially be from 8 until 2:30 and then rally afterwards.
And what time does rally go till?
That's a good question. I think another hour. Yes.
All right. Wow, what a great way to spend one summer. If people want more information, what does a week cost a student?
Right. So 1 week for full day would be $190. But we have the morning session for $114. We have afternoon for $76. And there's also, I'm glad you brought this up, because we do offer financial assistance for families in need. We don't want to turn anyone away because of their inability to pay. So what you would do is go to our website, junodance.org. And there you have all the information. You have the class schedules. You have tuition rates. You have the class descriptions. And then you can also contact us if you need an application for financial assistance.
What would you say has been one of the more popular classes in the past?
Ooh, that is a good one. My children love the cooking class. I think the teacher, Lynn Van Kirk, has been teaching that for about 18 years now. A really, really popular, really fun one. I know Raven's Tail Weaving is great. Lily Hope teaches that class.
Oh, wow.
Yes. And we're really excited about that one. But the dance classes are always great. We're offering juggling this year, jewelry making, and we have zine making, so make your own magazine, make your own comic book. There are a lot of really, really popular classes, drawing and calligraphy.
About how many kids participate in any given week, would you say?
Any given week, well, throughout the whole camp, we have about 350 students participating. So during the week, it varies, but we do cap each class at a maximum so that they don't get overcrowded. And each student has, you know, lots of individual attention. Another great aspect of the camp are the teen assistants that we bring in. So it's a wonderful opportunity for teens to get employment experience, but it's kind of twofold. They're mentoring the young campers, and they're also assisting and learning from these professional artist teachers. So it's a really wonderful experience for them.
And there are still openings for that, right?
Correct. Okay. Ages 14 and up. And again, you'd go through our website or contact our office for applications or more information.
Okay. This sounds like a lot of fun. And you say you have kids that will do all 4 weeks.
Oh, yes. Yeah, all 4 weeks. They love it. And you can pick different. So you can either stick with the same classes for all 4 weeks, or you can do, the student can mix it up and do different classes each week and get a really wide variety of these great enrichment opportunities.
Okay. If somebody wanted to learn more, remind us of the website.
Sure. junodance.org is our website, and our phone number is 463-5327.
All right, Julie, I think we covered it. Anything else you'd like to add?
That's it. I just want to thank the City and Borough of Juneau again for their support. This program really wouldn't be possible without them. So.
Okay. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you very much.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday. It's the 24th of April, 2017. Library of Congress established on this date in 1800 by President John Adams. It was destroyed by British soldiers in the War of 1812. Thomas Jefferson sold his collection of 6,500 books to begin a new collection at the library. And now, after the copyright law of 1870, every copyright applicant sends the library two copies of their work. 15,000 new items arrive every workday. It's the birthday of the Irish novelist Clare Boylan, born in Dublin, 1948, author of stories about the relationships between mothers and daughters. Her first novel, Holy Pictures, came out in 1983. It was on this date, 1916, Sir Ernest Shackleton set out in a lifeboat from Elephant Island to get help for his shipwrecked Antarctic expedition. They had been trapped in an ice pack aboard his ship, the Endurance. They had been drifting along with the ice for more than 9 months, and then they set up camp on this ice floe, on which they drifted for several months until finally they got off on an island. He left the island for South Georgia Island, where there was a whaling station on this day, 1916, and finally came back in August and rescued the survivors, one of whom said that when he saw Shackleton's ship on the horizon, "I felt jolly near blubbing for a bit and could not speak for several minutes." It's the birthday of the novelist Judy Budnitz, born in Atlanta, 1973. Her debut was in the book called Flying Leap. It came out in 1998. Author of stories about ordinary people in extraordinary circumstances that stretch the bounds of reality. Most recent collection, Nice Big American Baby. It's the birthday of the novelist Anthony Trollope, born in London in 1815. He worked at the post office, got up an hour before breakfast, sat down, and wrote 1,000 words. He said, "A small daily task, if it be really daily, will beat the labors of a spasmodic Hercules," author of The Barchester Towers and other books. And it's the anniversary of the Easter Rebellion in Dublin, 1916, a rebellion led by 6 patriotic poets and men of letters. Carrying antiquated rifles, they took over the post office. They were quickly captured by the British, who made the mistake of executing them a few weeks later. George Bernard Shaw wrote, "It is impossible to slaughter a man in this position without making him a martyr and a hero, even though the day before he may have been only a minor poet." And the failure of the rebellion set in motion a movement for independence, which succeeded in 1921. Ireland became independent from Great Britain. Here's a poem for today by Gary Snyder. What have I learned? What have I learned but the proper use for several tools? The moments between hard, pleasant tasks, to sit silent, drink wine, and think my own kind of dry, crusty thoughts. The first calicortus flowers, and in all the land it's spring, I point them out, the yellow petals, the golden hairs, to Jen, seeing in silence, never the same twice, but when you get it right, you pass it on. What Have I Learned, a poem by Gary Snyder from his collection No Nature, published by Pantheon Books and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Lumosity, with a 10-minute fit test to calculate baseline scores and training programs with 50 challenging brain games. Learn more at lumosity.com. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
You're listening to A Juno Afternoon here on Monday, April 24th. We're right at the bottom of the hour, and in the studio now with me is Natalie Watson. She is the coordinator for Girls on the Run with AWARE. Welcome to the show, Natalie.
Oh, thanks for having me.
All right. So the Girls on the Run race, sort of year-end event, is that right?
That's right. The season-end 5K is coming up.
And boys involved, too?
Yes. We also have a boys run program, and they will be running with the girls for the first time ever. So we've got 94 girls and 18 boys running together.
Will you outline the Girls on the Run and the boys program in the community for us,
please?
Yeah,
happy to. So Girls on the Run has been in Juneau since 2008, and it started with AWARE as one of their prevention strategies, working with youth to stop violence before it starts. And the mission is to inspire girls to be joyful, healthy, and confident. And we use a fun, experience-based curriculum, which creatively integrates running. So the whole season, they are building up their endurance. And then at the end, they all run the 5K together. And they really feel the sense of achievement.
I bet. And you are the coordinator, but you've also been a coach, right?
That's right, yeah. I get to coach both girls and boys.
And mostly, I think you mentioned this, but the program is for 3rd through 5th graders, right? And then at middle schools as well?
Yeah, we have a program for girls called Heart and Soul, and it's at both middle schools. And then Girls on the Run for 3rd to 5th grade girls, and Boys Run for 3rd to 5th grade boys.
Okay. When you were coaching, are you coaching this season
too?
Okay.
I am coaching, yeah.
For our listeners, can you think of an individual who's gone through your program that has benefited from it and sort of outline how it's helped her or him?
Yeah, I saw a lot of changes in the boys, especially last season. The program is so good at encouraging leadership positions that aren't really hierarchical. And so we saw boys taking leadership in a kind of caring way, which is unusual to see. So they would cheer each other on instead of being so competitive. And by the 5K, they were so good that, you know, one of the boys actually ran with the last boy the last several laps, cheering him on the whole way. So super inspiring.
Very cool. And what are sort of the, I guess, logistics or nuts and bolts of the program? How many days a week is it, and what's it look like?
Yeah, so we meet for 10 weeks, twice a week, 90 minutes each time, and it's an after-school program, and it's every semester.
Okay. And are you looking for volunteers for next year?
We are always looking for coaches for both programs, and coaches do not have to be runners, so you just have to be passionate about empowering youth.
What is it about the program that drew you to it initially?
Well, I guess it's the women's liberation aspect of it, and I'm very proud to work for AWARE and try to help women, you know, realize their confidence and learn that they can do anything they set out to do.
Okay. A great way to celebrate all of this would be at the 5K, right?
That's right. Yeah, so the 5K is Saturday, May 6th at Sandy Beach. We're going to start the celebrations at 10 a.m., and then the 5K starts at 10:30, and the community is welcome to join us. It's not a competitive race. It's a fun run.
I bet. And so it's at Sandy Beach, and does it go sort of back through those trails?
It does, yeah. Some really pretty trails back there.
Absolutely. If people want more information about how they could become a coach,
mm-hmm.
And again, those coaches a couple days after school.
Yeah, once or twice a week after school. For 10 weeks.
And you don't have to be a runner.
You do not.
If people want to be coaches or want to join this run mm-hmm. to participate, where can they find more info?
They can email me. That's the best way. So my email is nataliew@awareak.org. Or they can call. 586-4902. We also have a website for the girls' programs. It's GOTR, greateralaska.org.
And I think I found you on Facebook.
And we are on Facebook, too. Yeah,
today
the event
as well.
Is on there.
Excellent. You want to give us a quick update on AWARE and what else is going on?
Well, we just wrapped up a Take Back the Night event that was very successful. I'm not actually sure what's around the corner, so you'd have to ask our executive director about that.
I bet she'll be on the show soon. Well, I sure appreciate you coming on the show, Natalie. Is there anything else that you'd like to add?
Yeah, so we always like to thank our sponsors, Rainforest Pediatrics and Valley Medical Care. And also want to say, if you or a loved one are experiencing domestic violence, please call AWARE's Alaska toll-free crisis line at 1-800-478-1090.
All right, Natalie Watson, thanks for coming on the show. Meet her and all of the Girls on the Run participants and boys for the 5K at Sandy Beach May 6th. And give us your email once more, Natalie.
NatalieW@awareak.org.
Great. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Bird note. This cheery song belongs to the American robin. Belting out this distinctive message is one way that male robins defend their breeding territories from invasion by other robins. If a vocal warning does not deter an invading bird, a male robin, and cardinals and mockingbirds do this too, will fly at the intruder to scare it away. This usually does the trick, unless the intruder is the bird's own image reflected in a window, a hubcap, an outdoor mirror, or some other shiny surface. Hour after hour, a robin may fling into or peck at a reflective surface to drive away its assumed invader. Even if something scares the robin away, or it flies off on its own accord, the robin remembers where the reflection appeared and will return again and again to challenge the invader. Sometimes it will exhaust itself or even sustain injury in the battle. If you're sympathetic to robins and other songbirds hopelessly battering themselves, cover the outside of the problem window or remove the reflective surface. With the intruder safely removed, the American robin will return to singing, a more natural and safer method of protecting its breeding territory. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann.
You're listening to A Juno Afternoon here on Monday, April 24th, 2017. Scott Burton, your host. It's about 18 minutes until the top of the hour. In the studio with me is Professor Jim Powell from UAS. He teaches sustainability, among other things, in the Master of Public Administration program. And also on the phone with us is Cecil Stewart. Welcome to the show, Jim and Cecil.
Hello, good afternoon.
Yeah, it's nice to have you here, and how are you, Jim?
Good, thanks for having us on.
Yeah, it's nice to have you both here. It looks like we have a couple of workshops or lectures coming up on Wednesday and Thursday of this week. Jim, you want to outline those for us, and what's going on?
Sure, we have, we're very excited about having two folks coming into town, two experts on, I would say, sustainability, but also on city sustainability, and they're going to speak on food security the first night, and then the second night, the city we need, the city we want. So we have two speakers, Cecil Stewart, who is online, and then we have Sharon Kuska, who is a PhD professor at the University of Nebraska, and she's an architect engineer. And then Cecil is a dean emeritus to the architectural school at the University of Nebraska, and his head is really internationally known for architecture. He was the head of the American Institute of Architects, which is the premier organization, professional organization in the United States. So it's really neat that they're coming to town to talk about first food security, which we can all appreciate as we put our gardens in this spring, and then talk about city sustainability the next night. So that's this Wednesday. We'll start at 7 o'clock this Wednesday at UAS at the Glacier View room. And then Thursday, we'll start a little bit earlier at 5:30 downtown in the assembly chambers. And this is really a discussion. We want to have an open discussion as well as a presentation by them. So that's what we're looking to.
All right. Cecil, we're looking forward to having you here in town. Once you get here, what are a few things you plan to share with us?
Well, thank you very much. We are both very excited to come to Juneau. Jim and I have known each other for a number of years and made a lot of professional comparisons between Alaska and Nebraska. And our paths have crisscrossed on sustainable development in particular. We, over the years, through an organization that's a nonprofit that we created, have experimented with and made case studies from and done a lot of research on how do we measure sustainability? How does a community know when it's progressing or regressing? And we want to share some of that information in both sessions. The tool sphenometrics, and then we will move into some case study work that we have been involved with here in Lincoln, Nebraska, on the potential of local food systems increasing both in function and marketing. We have some USDA funding for grant research in this area, and we want to exchange and share information in particular because we're still at an early stage, and we understand that Alaska is also headed into a direction of more subsistence and sustainable food farming. So that would be the first night. The second night, we are involved also in some studies on workforce housing for our state, and we think there are many similarities between the two states there. So we think we have some food for thought and want to learn as much from the audience as we think we have to give. So
okay.
It should be two very interesting evenings.
Sounds like it. I've already learned a new word, sustainometrics. I like it.
Yeah.
I guess maybe we'll go back to you, Jim, for a minute. What are some examples of things that are working, either here in Alaska or around the nation, that I'm sure you'll touch on Wednesday? But just give us a little preview.
Well, I think if you I teach a class in food security and sustainability out at the university, and we've been exploring the history of agriculture and food in Alaska. And the trends that are happening right now are small farms. And you can see it in southeast and central Alaska. We tried to have big farms before. Some of you may have recalled, this goes back a ways, but in the 80s, we tried to do an agricultural land disposal and tried to incentivize large farms. Largely didn't work. And we had another experiment, too, through the government on at Delta. And those were, I guess they weren't organic enough, okay, grown. But now what's happening is the number of small farms is really increasing. I think there's more of an awareness, too, because people realize that we're dependent upon food from the outside. In fact, the factoids are 95% of our food comes from outside. That's not a great number. I think that we can move the dial. We can move the percentage from 5% up. I don't know how much, but I think we can move that dial in a positive way. Another reason is that our economy, we're so dependent upon oil. We have a very small agricultural piece. And if we can build that agricultural piece, then that would help the economy, too. We've got to start diversifying in any way we can. So I think that the factoid of only 5% of our food that we eat and consume comes from our state ourselves, we can improve in that area. So you're going to see, you are seeing, and there's programs for more commercialization of farming, more agriculture, like in Bethel. I don't know if you've heard that they have these tunnel farms now, these big Quonset huts that have been put up to try to do more commercial locally.
Okay. Cecil, how about you? What's working in Lincoln or maybe other things that are trending in your neck of the woods?
Well, it's really very interesting between these two states. We, of course, have big farms and have had for a number of years. And the commodities farmers in corn and soybeans rule the agricultural industry. However, the prices are falling. Water is depleting. Climate change is occurring, a migration of the growth seasons. And farmers here are beginning to look at breaking up some of these large commercial enterprises to more small acreages, and those small acreages, many of them are seeing that they can make a better living and get higher prices for food for people rather than food for animals and export. So I think it's important that we establish some common exchange reference points between the two states, and we want to be a part of supplying new information and new ideas. We also are studying a 12-month public food market in Lincoln, Nebraska. And that would be supplied wholly by people farming on small farms within 150 miles. But at the moment, there's not enough producers to supply a 12-month market. If we don't have a 12-month market, that sector will not grow. And if we don't have more producers with local food, we won't have a successful 12-month market. So we're trying to delve into both ends of this supply and demand spectrum, and we want to engage with you folks to see what we might share in common and how we could both succeed.
Okay. Beyond going on Wednesday and Thursday to the talks, almost sound like forums or community discussions, Jim, what can our listeners be doing? What should we be thinking about as we think about food security and what our city should be doing? You've answered it to some degree, but what are maybe some baby steps we can be doing at this time?
I think we've done some things. There's some nice trends going on. I mean, years ago we didn't have a farmer's market. We have one now. And I think that there are ways to incentivize. One thing that just happened this year is there's a we're going commercial with a flower. I think it's Pinoy. I forget the one of the flowers.
Like a peony, right?
Peonies, thanks.
Okay.
And that's the first time in this community since we had a dairy farm, which was in, I think, the 60s here, that we've gone commercial. And there's a place on North Douglas that that's actually gone through the permitting. But that was a variance to existing permitting procedures. So I think that the city can find maybe faster ways to permit commercialization and farms. More people are doing chickens. There's a lot of little spikes around, and the diversity is really increasing. So I think that City Hall can do that. Anyway, I think those are the some. I think you do it organically. I think you do it in small steps. But you see some steps by City Hall, and I think they've been open to it because our city government is, compared to many, is very innovative. In fact, they even have an innovations academy at the city. So I think that's part of it. There has to be some incentives by the government, and I think that I think there's a realization now that local food is smart, it's efficient, it's it helps the economy, it helps health. I think it's really, and then you know, a lot of times we overlook the fisheries here too, and that's a big one. I mean, most of our food, our fish, goes out of state, and I know for a long time when I was on the assembly, the commercial fishermen would come in and go, "Come on, you got to help us with the docks here. You got to help us with cold storage. You got to help us more." So I think that there's a lot of things that are in front of us that we can do better at in small ways.
Okay, and can you give us the details again on Wednesday and Thursday's presentations?
Mm-hmm. Okay, on Wednesday, it's at 7 o'clock at UAS in the Glacier View Room. That's on at UAS, and that's on food security. So we're going to have an open discussion on that, some presentations. We're also going to have a short presentation by one of my graduate students, Sig Topcock, is going to speak on subsistence. And that's a very – she grew up in Nome. She's a law student. Anyway, so we're going to have some neat presentations, I think, there. So that's food security, Wednesday night, 7 to 8:30. Out at the university, and then downtown at the assembly chambers at 5:30, and that's going to be, we've titled it, The City We Need, The City We Want, and that's sustainability.
Cecil, what are you looking forward to most about these two presentations?
Well, I'm looking forward mostly to the exchange, the interaction. We want to give folks a bit of a taste of what we're struggling with, and we think it'll be a quick recognition that we have so much in common that we ought to be sharing search for common practices and sharing of research and studies.
Okay. Jim, if people want more information, where should they go?
can give me a call at 209-5676. That's 907-209-5676. Or you can reach me at my email, and you can find that easily on the UAS website under the School of Management.
All right. You guys, thank you for your time. We've been speaking with Jim Powell and Cecil Stewart. They have put together Food Security and Juno Wednesday from 7 to 8:30 at UAS, and also The City We Need and The City We Want on Thursday, the 27th, from 5:30 to 7 at the CBJ Assembly Chambers. Jim, anything else you'd like to add?
No, just thank you very much, and everybody's invited. It's free. Come on down.
How about you, Cecil? Anything you want to add?
Well, thanks to Jim and to the City of Juneau for this invitation. We're really excited about being there.
Great. We'll see you on Wednesday.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jim.
Thanks.
Friends of the Juneau Douglas City Museum invite you to a free presentation, 1867 to 2017, 150 years of change, off on E, Small Lake Tribe land at the time of purchase. May 4th, 6:30 to 8 at the Juneau Arts and Humanities Council. On the anniversary of the purchase of Russian interest in Alaska by the U.S., naturalist and co-founder of Discovery Southeast, Richard Karstensen, will present before and after photos celebrating Juneau's original inhabitants, exploring the land we live on and how it has changed. Information at 586-3572 or juneau.org/library/museum.
Thank you for tuning in to a Juneau Afternoon. Tomorrow, I'll be your host as well. We'll get another preview of Wednesday's Pillars of America presentation. Sarah Campin will be here to highlight the 100 Voices Community Arts Showcase. We'll talk with Elaine Schroeder about 350, the Climate Change Organization, and Riverbend teacher T.J. Kramer about the production Lost in the Woods. Currently 54 degrees here in the capital city. Forecast for tonight calls for scattered showers, mostly cloudy, with a low around 35.